Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the upcoming University of Tulsa presidential lecturer, journalist, and author Evans Osnos. Osnos is currently a Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker, covering politics and foreign affairs, and the author of the 2014 National Book Award nonfiction-winning book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China, which is based on over a decade's worth of reporting from that country. For 4 years, he wrote The Letter from China for NewYorker.com, and prior to that, he was the Beijing bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune. His article, The Fallout, won the 2012 Overseas Press Club Award, and he's a part of the Tribune's investigative team, which won a 2008 Pulitzer. Currently, he's covering the Trump administration for The New Yorker, but he'll be speaking about China when he gives the TU presidential lecture Tuesday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. Evan Osnos joins me today by phone. Evan Osnos, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Happy to be here.
Currently, for The New Yorker, you're covering Washington now and the Trump campaign, but for a number of years, you were covering China. And your book, Age of Ambition, examines what I'd say China's two-pronged trajectory, this massive economic expansion, which, you know, last year they had the lowest growth they've had in 20-something years, and it was still 6.6%, against this resolute authoritarian political system. That seems to fly in the face of what we think about how governments evolve when they create wealth.
Right. You know, you're absolutely right. And it's, in some ways, it's that paradox that drew me there and kept me there, this idea that you could have a country that was really doubling the size of its economy every 7 or 8 years, but without opening up the boundaries for political discussion or for criticism of government or for the kinds of routine political cut and thrust which we have come to associate so closely with not only democratic discourse, but also the vibrant free market. And so that, trying to understand how these two very different facts could coexist, became, for me at least, the kind of puzzle that was enough to keep me living in Beijing for 8 years.
So did you ever come up with an answer? Because, I mean, we think of this model of when a country has massive economic growth, first of all, the people are going to want a greater say in the operation of the government.
Yeah.
Why is China able to have these two twin tracks?
Well, I think there's two reasons. The first reason is that China was coming from a very different place, obviously, than where we were in the West, in the sense that, you know, for most of modern history, meaning the last few hundred years, China has regarded itself as a place of chaos and weakness. I mean, really, until 1949, which is when the Communist Revolution restored power into the hands of a one-party state, it really was, China believed that it had been a victim, to use its word, of foreign invasion and of economic distress, and in some ways it was true. I mean, they really had been, in the Chinese term, carved up like a melon by foreign powers who came in and took control of different parts of the countries. What that meant was that the country was really so depleted and in such disrepair that when they began finally to begin to march out of poverty and begin to really turn towards the of open market reforms in the late 1970s that were so vital, people were just so desperate for some improvement in their lives that they were willing to postpone, is really the word I decided is best to describe it, to postpone some of the freedoms that we associate with other kinds of free market economies. So people put off for years the idea that they would be able to criticize the government or that they would be able to choose their leaders. Now, what happens, of course, and this really is the crux of my work over the last few years and was the subject of my book, is that the more people began to accommodate and get used to the idea of economic freedom, well, it became a lot harder for them to imagine that they were still not going to have control over their political and intellectual lives. And that creates a new kind of tension where people who really have quite sophisticated economic experiences where they're starting businesses and they're stitched into the rest of the world and they have this huge presence, obviously, in the world economy, then find it sort of strange and out of sorts that they are not able to have a greater say over the political affairs of their country. So that's where China finds itself now, is confronting that tension.
And how much of that accommodating, if you will, goes back to Tiananmen Square?
Yeah, in some ways, Tiananmen Square was a preview of the world to come. But in many ways, it was a preview of a world that was still two decades off. We all remember 1989. That was when the students flooded into Tiananmen Square and they occupied the square for weeks. It was an amazing thing to see on television. And for me, at least, it was also the thing that ultimately drew me to China. I was just fascinated by this event. I mean, if you imagine the equivalent thing happening in the United States, it would have been like, you know, students pouring into the center of Washington, D.C., and then setting up a tent city and living there for weeks while they demanded things of their government. And what happened in Beijing's case, as we all know, is that it ended in bloodshed. But it also was a preview of a much more demanding era. An era in which Chinese people were going to ask more of their government and really expect more out of life. There was a great moment, which I think of a lot, which is that a student said to a reporter, one of the student demonstrators told a reporter, he said, "I don't know exactly what we want, but we want more of it." And in some ways, that sense of demand, that sense of greater ambition and expectation is now the defining driving dynamic of the country.
I have to mention, you said, you know, it's like an army occupying Washington. We did have that in the 1930s with the Bonus Army, and we did the same thing the Chinese did.
Yeah.
And we forget that at our peril. But as you mentioned, this sort of pent-up demand, do you think there's going to be more pressure on the government to accommodate more diverse opinion?
There is. This is now arguably one of the greatest challenges that the government faces, is how do you acculturate a rising generation to be creative and entrepreneurial and innovative and disruptive? I mean, that, after all, is the great buzzword of the digital economy, is how do you disrupt these old incumbent industries and come up with the next big thing? But how do you do that without also allowing a greater degree of independence and autonomy and freedom in political and intellectual life? And that's really hard. And I want to add one thing, which I think is in some ways, you know, the thing that's easiest to miss from abroad, which is that we might naturally assume that young Chinese people would say, "Well, I want democracy." The answer is they actually don't use that terminology at all. It's kind of toxic. You know, they don't, typically you won't hear young Chinese say, "We want a political system like yours in the United States." That for them feels too odd, too foreign. What they really say is, "We just want to have more control over areas of our own lives, and we want to have more justice, fairness, and transparency in our government." And that's, I think that's a sort of realistic target on the horizon for where it is that the Chinese government needs to get.
What do they mean by control? The ability to read what they want, say what they want, within reason?
Yeah, I mean, to give you a literal example, if you go online today in Beijing, you can have access to just about the entire world of electronic commerce. You can buy anything you want. You can, you know, have it shipped to you in China. It's incredibly fast and quite sophisticated economy in delivery of sort of, you know, if you take your Amazon experience and you multiply it 10 times over, you can get anything delivered to you in China by ordering it on the web. However, you can't go online and read a whole range of some of the world's most, you know, respected news organizations.
I mean, like the New Yorker.
Well, the New Yorker, I think we are, for whatever reason, they don't pay as much attention to us, perhaps, until this interview. But you know, the New York Times is banned, BBC, Wall Street Journal on some days. A whole list of news organizations are inaccessible. And that is frustrating to a young person who sees themselves as being international and cosmopolitan.
Right. My guest today is Evan Osnos, the staff writer at The New Yorker, who won the 2014 National Book Award for Nonfiction for his book Age of Ambition: Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be a University of Tulsa presidential lecturer Tuesday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. In your book, you tell a lot of these big themes through personal stories. Some people who are probably well-known, others not known in the West. One who might be somewhat known is Justin Lin-Yi Fu. He's the World Bank chief economist, who has this amazing story.
Yeah, he really captured my attention, and really in some ways he was almost reluctant to tell his story. He doesn't tell it very often, but you know, the amazing thing about Justin Lin-Yi Fu, when I met him, he was Now, the chief economist of the World Bank, he's got this very sedate and sort of scholarly job. And it turns out that his life actually in many ways is a trajectory of what brought China to this moment. He was born in Taiwan, which, as you know, is the breakaway province from China. It's an island off the coast. And when he was a young man, he became convinced that China was on the cusp of a revival, that it was going to be an economic powerhouse in the future. And this is in the late 1970s, when most people hadn't realized that. But Justin Lin saw something, and he was right. But in order to get to China, he had to swim, literally. And so he went AWOL from Taiwan's military, dove into the water, and swam about a mile to reach the Chinese coast. He was on a little island that was a very sort of distant outpost, the closest outpost to the Chinese mainland. And he lands on the Chinese shore. They don't know what to do with him, frankly. They thought this guy must be a spy. So they detained him and they interrogated him. And eventually they concluded he's not a spy. He's just somebody who really believes that his future is in China. And then he was allowed to leave to go and sort of make his way in China, and he ended up going off and going to university, and I'll leave the rest of the story unsaid now, but it's in some ways his, that sheer audacity, the idea that he was going to physically transform his life's parameters by taking this extraordinary risk, that idea became for me a really helpful way of understanding how China has catapulted itself from one phase of life into this completely new moment by, it's made up economic ground at a pace like no civilization in history. Nobody's ever developed as fast or as far as they have, and they were willing to risk and sacrifice a lot along the way. And that story captured that better than anyone I ever encountered.
I think there's a tendency in the West to think that the huge buildup of wealth in China has been somewhat of the same as in Russia, where it was political connections, it was being part of the nomenclatura that sort of gave you the entree into wealth. Certainly, there are some stories like that in China, but there was some amazing stories of social mobility. I think it's Gong Hainan as another peasant who became a billionaire by creating this dating site in China.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that there are certainly cases where having a brother-in-law who was a local party official would give you access to basically companies that you could take control of. And that is familiar from a lot of post-Soviet nations and also countries with poor rule of law. But there was also, alongside that, a kind of almost a gold rush Wild West quality about the ability to be able to go out, stake your claim, build your business, and make something. One of the stories that I may tell when I'm in Tulsa is the story of a woman who decided she was trying to find somebody to marry. And so what she did was she started the Chinese equivalent of Match.com and ended up building it into the most successful dating website in China. She took it public on the NASDAQ, made a fortune. And all of this happened in this very short period of time when I was living there. And, what's interesting, and I think it's worth mentioning that in some ways, when you tell a story like that or you talk about somebody like that, it's not because we say that they're typical. In no way, there's nothing typical about building a fortune, out of nothing. But in the same way that we're fascinated by the story of Steve Jobs and what it says about America, there is something to be learned about stories of extraordinary ambition and capability in China.
Now, you spent, a better part of off and on over the course of, 15 years from first visit as a student?
Yeah, I first went to China in 1996, and I moved back to the United States in 2013. But I really lived there. The longest stretch I was there was for 8 years.
Can you give us a sense of what you witnessed as far as the transformation of the economy, say, from the beginning of those 13, 15 years to the end?
Sure. I mean, one metric is that the first time that the first time that I went to China to study Chinese, which was in 1996, it had this economy that was smaller than Italy's economy at the time. Now you fast forward to today, and China's economy is obviously either number one or number two, depending on how you measure it. And the speed and the scale of China's economic growth is really many times larger than the speed and scale of the first industrial revolution, which transformed Britain. And that can be hard for people to visualize, except that, to put it in perspective, China has used more cement, more concrete, over the course of the last 10 or 15 years than the United States did over decades and decades. And there's just a level of physical transformation that you almost get used to in China, but you don't experience elsewhere, to the degree that I would sometimes go away for a vacation, for instance, or I'd go on a work trip, I'd go reporting somewhere, and I'd come back 2 or 3 weeks later, and the building next door to my house, this happened on one occasion, the building next door to my house had been leveled, and they were already beginning to rebuild it as something different. And there was and that was totally ordinary. So in some ways, you kind of got used to this process of creative destruction going on around you. And it's thrilling. I mean, if you talk to people who have gone over there to study or to work or to start businesses, one of the reasons why they go is not because it's easy. It's certainly not an easy place to do any of those things. But it is a reminder, at least it reminds me, of what it must have been like in the United States at the turn of the end of the 19th century, the turn of the 20th century, because we were at the same stage of going from a largely agricultural country to a mostly urban country. And all of the extraordinary dynamics that are involved in that are sort of on vivid display every day in places like Beijing and elsewhere.
Except the timeline has been compressed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, there's a couple big questions about the future of China. One is, it's now seemingly a maturing economy, which means no more 9%, 10% growth. It's more like 6% growth, and perhaps that will even fall further as the country matures. It's also an aging country, and income inequality is a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
How do you expect the state to maintain that control? Are they going to have to gradually liberalize? What do you see as the biggest issue, and how the government's going to have to confront those issues?
Well, the things you just identified are absolutely top of mind. There's no question they're dealing with the fact that, for instance, you know, the economy is on pace now to drop below 6% annual GDP growth by 2020, which, you know, still sounds pretty good to a lot of countries. But if you are a Chinese political leader, what you're thinking about is, I've got thousands and thousands of new college graduates who are entering the workforce every year, and I have to make sure the economy's growing fast enough to accommodate them. If not, I run the risk of political unrest. And, you know, in some ways, that's a dynamic that many countries face, except that in China, there is no organized way of accommodating that sort of those political complaints. You know, you can't vote the bums out, in a sense. You have to figure out a way of registering your discontent, and that creates a lot of political uneasiness. But, you know, it might surprise you, Rich, that I think the issue that is even more urgent in some ways than the economic slowdown is environmental. I mean, if you talk to young people in China today, what they will often tell you is that they feel unsafe. That's the word that comes up over and over again. And they feel unsafe because of the air they're breathing or because of the food that they're eating. They don't know what was in the ground or what was used to grow that produce. And there have been a series of scandals involving food safety. But really, the thing that is so clear, as many, I think, probably listeners who've been to Beijing will know, is that there is really just extraordinary levels of air pollution. China has many of the world's most polluted cities. And that's not unique to China. The United States, of course, had a period with immense environmental pollution, and other developing economies have as well. But in China, the scale and the effects are profound, and so they're trying now to get it under control. But in the meantime, it's of tremendous political energy, and a very uncertain political energy, and that's something that keeps the government up at night.
And that's the whole thing. The uncertain political energy is probably the deepest fear of a lot of the leaders.
Yeah, very much so.
How this energy will react.
Well, they will tell you the Chinese Communist Party is, as we know, it's now the longest serving one-party state that's still in existence, the longest enduring Communist Party. And that worries them. You know, they don't wear that crown lightly. They know that that means that they are at risk of some fundamental change, some political transformation, and they're trying to prevent it, or at least trying to make sure that whatever happens doesn't send them out of power abruptly. So that's the thing that weighs on them.
My guest today, Evan Osnos, the staff writer at The New Yorker. He spent a number of years reporting from China. Now he's reporting from Washington. And you covered the 2016 presidential campaign. And In September of last year, you wrote what is appeared to be a very prescient article on President Trump's first term, which predicted the executive orders he's already signed, the conflicts of interest over the Trump Organization, immigration ban, increase in deportations, and basically his adherence to his campaign rhetoric, which everybody in September, when you were writing this, said would moderate. So having been right about all that, has there been any surprises so far as you cover the Trump administration?
Yeah, I guess the interesting experience for me in writing that was that I felt as if, actually, if you looked closely at what Donald Trump was saying and if you listened to what he was talking about and spoke to his advisors and didn't get caught up in some of the stylistic distractions, that actually he made it all quite clear what it was he was going to do. And if we pretended that he was going to be somebody else in office than he was on the campaign trail, well, that was our own magical thinking. I mean, that was really not supported by every piece of data that he provided us, because all of this was visible. But that being said, you know, it would have been impossible to predict, I think, some of the ways in which his presidency has been so, you know, it's a cliche now to say that everything is unpredictable about him. But I guess the part that surprises me is how much all of Washington is trying to figure him out. You know, he is exactly the same person he was a year ago and 5 years ago. That's the thing that's interesting, is that if you're a 70-year-old businessman who made money doing a certain kind of thing for basically 50 years, you don't wake up one day and decide that everything that got you to this moment was wrong, and you're therefore going to change in order to accommodate to Washington. And so in some ways, the biggest surprise is that Washington expected him to be somehow different. And of course he was never going to be different. And I don't know exactly where this story ends, but it is a phenomenon. I mean, we really have never had in a very, very long time somebody come into the White House who is more philosophically and psychologically at odds with the
Right. And you know, a lot of it is how Washington is dealing with it.
Exactly.
And I think I'm wondering if you've been doing much investigating on how the average Trump voter, whether he or she expected Trump to change from his campaign rhetoric and whether that's making a difference. Because from what I can see from the interviews, they expected him to do what he said he was going to do, and they're seemingly okay with it so far.
Well, I think what you find is that, you know, there are different kinds of Trump voters, obviously. There are some who were attracted to his declarations of war with the establishment. Mm-hmm. They wanted somebody to come in and just change things. They just were frustrated.
Drain the swamp, yeah.
Exactly, drain the swamp. Then there were others who had very specific policy hopes out of Donald Trump. And I'll take it as an example, West Virginia, where I used to live. West Virginia, you know, a lot of people in West Virginia really wanted Donald Trump to do what he said he would, which is to bring back coal and to revive the state's really struggling economy. If you go there today, what you find is that people are saying, well, I'm pleased so far that he has tried to change the EPA and he's going to abandon the Clean Power Plan, which was a big part of Barack Obama's legacy. But I think the real question is going to be what happens in a year when really any sober, independent economic analyst will tell you those coal jobs, I'm afraid, are really not coming back. They're just not going to come back. That's not going to be there. There may be some jobs around the edges, but as a fundamental piece of the economy, that is not going to change, and no president is able to change that. So I think the question becomes, Donald Trump ran on a platform of being able to deliver very specific things, and if he's not able to deliver those things, like any president, then his voters will hold him accountable. He set the bar very high for himself, and it's going to be very hard for him to meet it on some of these things.
I want to ask end with an article you wrote recently, and it's a trend that has been, I guess it's been escalating over the last few years, which is survivalism moving into the ranks of the super rich, the plutocrats, if you will.
Yeah.
It's got an amazing follow and bounce from that particular article. Where did you first hear about this idea that, you know, the super rich are making plans to move to New Zealand or buy an island and stock it with stock a larder and stock it with ammunition? Where did this article come from? What was the inspiration?
Well, I'll tell you, I've never written a story that's had, I think, more of a public reaction than this one. It's been sort of eye-opening for me. But the story began, I was on an airplane one day coming back from something, and I started chatting with the guy sitting next to me, and he was, it turned out, an executive at a Silicon Valley company. And I said, hey, what's going on out in Silicon Valley that I should write about? What's interesting? And he said, well, have you written about the doomsday preppers in Silicon Valley? And I said, what? I had no idea what he was talking about. And it turned out, actually, he said, yeah, if you start asking around, you may be able to learn something about it. He said, you won't find much online about it, and that's not by accident. They keep a lot of that. They don't like to talk about it very much, but you may find that people will talk to you. And so, sure, I started talking to people, and in the beginning, nobody really wanted to talk about the idea that they were buying property or buying antibiotics and ammunition and guns and gold. But eventually they did, and I ended up talking to a large number of people who are sort of involved in this kind of activity because they feel uneasy about the country, either politically or because they worry that Silicon Valley will somehow become a target of public frustration as the labor force continues to evolve. But it was, from my perspective, it was an interesting story because it's a window into a moment of anxiety, a little bit about how we feel a little uneasy about the country, no matter where we stand politically. And so we decided that would be worth a story.
I was really struck by what was sort of the subtext, which is guilt.
Yeah.
It's guilt about, I'm making a gazillion dollars a year, and rather than, okay, maybe spread that wealth around,
right,
I'm afraid somebody's going to come down, you know, we're going to come down with pitchforks and take it away from me.
Yeah, that was, I agree with you. That was a surprise for me. And as one of the voices in this piece mentioned, there's a CEO who I quoted who is in some ways a kind of counterpoint to this phenomenon. He lives in Silicon Valley. He's a very successful entrepreneur. His name is Max Levchin, and he started a bunch of companies, and he's a billionaire. And Max said, you know, this comes up all the time in conversation among my friends and peers, and it bothers me. He says it's the one thing that bothers me most of all. And I say to friends, I said, look, if you're so worried about the pitchforks, as he called them, well, how much have you given to your local homeless shelter? And he says that tends to shut down conversation. But I was appreciative, I have to say, of the people who spoke to me for that story from all sides, because it was, they were sort of putting their money where their mouth is, saying, okay, yeah, I'll stand up for my beliefs. But it was not a wholly reassuring portrait of where some of America's wealthiest people are, how they feel at the moment.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to hearing the presidential lecture on China and other topics. Evan, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rich.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the winner of the 2014 National Book Award for Nonfiction for his book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. He'll be the University of Tulsa presidential lecturer this coming Tuesday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center, and that lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.